This is John Beebe, January of 1999. Further into character typology.
Many other stories that I found myself wondering if we could just sort of look at the whole thing anew and see if we couldn't see it a little differently. One can cast it in these heroic terms, but I wonder if it doesn't in some way violate the spirit. So let me show you a little bit of where I'm. Analyzing images that I get in film generally, and here are a few from some well-known films, just to show you the relation so that you can get the method of film analysis. This is The African Queen, which many of you will have seen. You know that movie about the missionary, the English missionary woman played by Katharine Hepburn, whose mission is burned down by the Germans in Africa right at the outset of World War I. And she gets on the little boat, the African Queen, operated by Charlie Allnut, played by Humphrey Bogart. And she induces him to join her in the project of blowing up the German ship, the Luisa. So they go all down a long journey to get to the lake where they can blow up the Luisa. And in the process, these two very unlikely people come together. Just saying Katharine Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart should say enough. This is a very unlikely pairing. And yet it was one of the most satisfying experiences on the screen, and it's the only time Bogart got his Academy Award. Now, as I see that particular film, I believe that Bogart is a pretty clear image of introverted feeling, and that Hepburn is a very clear example of extroverted thinking. She's very much like a general. She really knows what she wants and how it should be done, and she's very much a director of traffic. And she's very much in the superior position, and he's very much in the inferior position. In fact, he's almost a tramp. He's sort of unshaven, and he's sort of, and he drinks too much, and she's extremely proper Edwardian lady, and in the movement of the film, he comes up and she lowers herself a little, and so we have the pleasing quality of she becomes less superior and he becomes less inferior, and they actually meet. And when they meet, they are able to develop an enormous integrity as a couple. And it's the integrity as a couple which makes their coming together so exciting, because in this union of opposites, there is great integrity and great moral force, and it's that they can bring to the project of blowing up the Luisa. And the Luisa, I think, would represent the patriarchal anima, which is being blown up. And the African Queen would represent a healthy feminine principle coming from the country of the African mother goddess, you see. In other words, I think the movement of the film is to move the patriarchal anima out and to replace it with a healthy feminine principle. So it's a very powerful and exciting film, and it turns simply on the relationship between the two people. And they're such good actors, and they make, and Huston directs it so well. And so it enables me to emphasize the vertical line here, which I call the spine of the personality, and in this case it's the spine of this particular film. And that spine is what I consider to be the axis of integrity. When I speak of integrity in depth, it's a very practical thing for me. It's when the superior function makes a connection to the inferior function. And we can't do that if we're only interested in the trivial integrity of the superior function, that is, maintaining the consistency of our own point of view. We have to open ourselves up to the point of view of another and be open to the fact that another could be as important as we are. I mean, that's the beginning of real integrity, which always involves not just the ability to stay true to oneself, but to honestly be responsible to the other. So that was the big discovery when I wrote that book, Integrity in Depth. When we really achieve that level of things in which the whole of which we are only a part has some purchase on our feelings, that's the point at which I think we can speak of true psychological and moral integrity. So it's not simply self-consistency, and it's achieved psychologically through this join, which is so beautifully shown in an ideal way in this movie. In fact, it's extremely difficult to lower yourself, and it's extremely difficult to come up, and in life often people cannot make the connection just on that vertical axis. That's the book. In the movie, it's a definite plan. They decide. Often the movies are better than the books, and the movie in the movie, it's quite definite that they decide to put dynamite in the boat and sacrifice the African queen by turning it into a torpedo. Right. Well, I still think synchronicity accompanies integrity also. I mean, I think the movie clearly relates their success to their integrity, but you're quite right. I'd have to go back and see the movie. It may ultimately be an accident at the last minute in the movie too. I don't think it takes away the psychological point. The point is the conjunctio produces the result. That's the point. I mean, but maybe not in the way of a superior function. I mean, maybe you're right about that. So maybe that's an interesting detail. Psychological integrity has very little to do with will. I mean, you get yourself connected to yourself, and things then start happening in the right way. I mean, it's much different than planning everything out and achieving it. I rarely work when I'm working with that, I always connect with myself. I don't do it through the will. I do it through what the self. So I'll have to look again. You may be the same in the movie. Now, to go forward. we're losing the point of the line that's so hard to draw. Many of you will have seen the movie Broadcast News, and if you haven't, I advise you to watch it because the types are so clear in that movie. It's a tight movie. And here we have again an extroverted thinking heroine and an introverted feeling hero. But they never are able to finally connect. She cannot ultimately lower herself, and he cannot bring himself up to her point of view. They try throughout the movie to connect, and it never quite works. There's one exquisite scene in the middle of the film where they go on a date where it looks like they're going to be able to make love at last at the end of the date. And she's high on a balcony. She says, if he looks up and sees me, it'll be okay. And he does look up, and they exchange, and then she rides an escalator down, and he starts running up the escalator. And at that moment, you can see the chance of the meeting of the superior and the inferior function, just beautifully illustrated for us. But they can't sustain it. She has to go back into her thinking mode. He starts to feel her erotically. And she says, could you at least kiss me when you do that? And then she starts to take over again. And then she has a plan that she has to do. And then then he finally asserts his feeling again, that he doesn't want to be controlled by her. And so they go their separate ways. And then they argue about a matter of principle. And he can't see her idea of integrity. She can't see his idea of feeling, giving one a chance to bend the rules in a certain area, and they can never come together. So this film is complicated by the fact that there is another man in the picture who's very interested in the heroine. And that's the character played by Albert Brooks, who plays a character named Aaron in the film. And Aaron is the best friend of Jane. He would like very much to be her lover, but he doesn't say so openly until relatively late in the film. And so we have a structure of the film very much like films like The Philadelphia Story, where we have a woman and two men, and we have to ask ourselves about what, in effect, are two onimous figures, except that they are so different in their presentation that I have decided that they shouldn't both be called onimous, even though they both are figures of the opposite sex. One, Aaron, is extremely oppositional in just about everything he says and does, and the other is very charming and handsome and elegant and seductive. That's the William Hurt character. She, in fact, doesn't get it together with either of them, but it brings up the interesting problem that the heroine has not only an onimus, she also has an opposing personality. And that's what I wanted to bring up with that particular diagram. One can see that same structure with a man and two women, this time when the leading function is not one of the rational, that is, feeling or thinking functions, but the leading function is sensation in the well-known movie Blue Velvet, where again there are two figures that one could call anima figures if one liked. One is, at least they're figures of the opposite sex. One is the character played by Laura Dern, who I think is really the anima, who is this introverted sensation type's extroverted intuitive girlfriend, who knows things and connects him to secrets that lead him on in the deciphering of the mystery. The other is the woman who is so problematic for him, who is Dorothy, the Blue Velvet lady, and the Blue Velvet... Her general voluptuousness and sexiness, she would be in sync with that figure that I showed you in the movie The Grifters last night, played by Annette Bening, an image of an extroverted sensation woman, and she's shadowy and problematic and extremely oppositional to this young man. In fact, she wants to... get him to engage in some sadomasochistic lovemaking with her, and he's very offended by that and horrified, but she provokes him finally into slugging her once, and he feels enormous shame and guilt at the gesture. But it's as if to say the only way to make love with the opposing personality is oppositionally. We have again this interesting structure that one hero, two contrasexual figures in very different places with different types. So we can apply that model to the most well-known film of all, Casablanca. And here, once again, we have Humphrey Bogart marvelously paired with a woman who seems to be an opposite to him, but a very different kind of opposite from Katharine Hepburn. If Bogart, with his brooding melancholy and his expressive face and his few words and his hidden gentlemanliness, is about as good an image as you're ever going to get of introverted feeling, Ingrid Bergman, with her expressive, immediate face, the tears that come easily, the enormous relatedness and responsiveness that she gives to all her performances, is about as good an image of extroverted feeling as one could ever get. And, of course, her well-known fickleness, too, both on and off the screen. We get very much this pair of opposites. And, in fact, their wills are clearly opposed throughout most of the film, although we remember their coming together and the way it feels when they are together. In fact, through most of the film, she has either left him or he is saying that she has to go. In other words, there's very little time when they're really just having their love affair with each other. And they're usually arguing with each other about she leaves him when he wants the relationship, then he says she must go when she wants the relationship. So most of the thing is in opposition. When the two halves of the feeling function come together, it's extraordinary, and there's an enormous love lift, and it's one giant feeling, and that's what happens when two halves of a function come together. But typologically, they're opposed, and archetypally, they have a tendency to go apart. So, if Ingrid Bergman isn't the anima, my goodness, what could John Beebe be thinking of? What is he calling the anima? I mean, isn't the anima supposed to be Ingrid Bergman? Isn't it supposed to look like that? Isn't she as close as we'll get to the woman whose face shines like the sun? Well, in this particular movie, I think the anima is the song. And I'll try to prove it to you if you follow my logic that the introverted feeling Bogart is the hero. You know the great moment when the song is played, Play It, Sam, and then says Bergman, and he plays, you must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is still a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. Now, hearts full of passion, jealousy, and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate, that no one can deny. Now, you tell me that isn't inferior extroverted thinking. The song was so bad it was cut from two Broadway shows before it finally showed up in that movie, and only because of the wonderful way it's sung in the movie and the way it fits into the structure of the whole film, it sort of becomes a kind of suffusing anima ideology of love that sort of underpins the whole thing and makes the whole romantic movie work. So it's one of those things where a movie can achieve something in its alchemy that makes the individual elements so much better than they are. So the inferior function's where it ought to be, and it becomes a kind of a theme. I don't think he's as important as the song. I mean, I know what you're saying, but I in this case, it's the message that's met. I've never been able to type Sam to my utter satisfaction. I'm not. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. I understand. I was trying to get at the type of the song. Their length. And what do you think Sam's type is?
I'm not sure.
Right. I think that's probably right. I think it's a case where the trickster and the anima come together, which is a theme that I've developed a lot. And I think it may add to some of the sense of power of the thing. I mean, that he's a jazz singer. Jazz has a lot of the... And I think it's his jazz singing that gives the trickster spin that makes the bad extroverted thinking lyric work. So I think you're right. I think it's an anima that has integrated the spirit of the trickster, and so therefore, I think you're absolutely right. In fact, for there to be integrity, I have learned that the trickster has to be integrated. So your comment is most helpful to bring that in. These were deep waters I wasn't planning to get into, but I'm glad you got us into them because you're right. So if we were to figure out his typology, I'm not sure, but it would be... it would probably be... I've always had a little trouble with some of the side figures in this film, so it would be an extroverted type, but I'm not sure whether sensation or intuition in terms of the model. But the point being that he's a trick. There's a certain trickster aspect to it all. Now, the point of this is just to say that the anima or animus does not itself need to be a character. That's what I wanted to get you to see. The fact that the trickster is personified by character. The song can be something else. Just as in a dream, a ship can be the anima or a lake or something can be... In other words, it's very important that you not locate these only with people. Nor is the movement from the superior to the inferior function always the be-all and the end-all of every story. This is Beauty and the Beast, which I showed you some of last night. And there we have a definite hero in the local man, Gaston, who has all of his ideas. But this is a post-heroic story. And you have to get used to post... We're in post-modern, post-patriarchal, post-colonial, post-heroic times. And so the stories are also changing. And this story comes up strongly now as a post-heroic story. And in the post-heroic story, Bell has already established the integrity down there, and her movement is already toward the other side of the diagram. She's putting into all of her energy into the connection with Beast, and she has no libido whatsoever any longer for the hero. So it isn't a story about Gaston killing the Beast and claiming Belle. It's a story about Belle getting away from Gaston altogether and getting into another kind of engagement with the Beast, which I tried to show you last night in the image of the dance, which is a very different model from a mastery model. It's a relational model. So stories take place at different levels, and typing it out, I gave Gaston extroverted thinking because he has such definite ideas about how their life should go, and Belle, introverted feeling, very self-contained, and Beast, this very demonic, ambivalent, extroverted feeling. Brings us to Dorothy and her and the people in the Wizard of Oz. Now, once Dorothy gets into Oz, she immediately develops two more or less human companions, and then there are two animal companions, the Toto who she brought with her and the Cowardly Lion. So the two more or less human companions are the Scarecrow and the Tin Woodman. And it's very easy to see that Dorothy, as played by Judy Garland, is a particularly good image of extroverted feeling. She's extremely responsive to the feelings of others around her at all times, which is part of why they love her so much. One sees that even at the beginning when she's of the film, when she's talking to Aunt Em, trying to tell her about the threat to Toto from Elvira Gulch. And Aunt Em says, "Dorothy, we're trying to count, not now, please. These one of our incubators has broken down, and the chicks may freeze." And she immediately picks up the chick and says, "Oh, the poor things." You know, she's constantly there with her feeling. And it's an extraordinarily expressive extroverted feeling that comes through this actress. And the Scarecrow, who's terribly concerned with not having a brain, is a marvelous, clear image of introverted thinking in the inferior position. He has the classic inferiority complex about thinking, and yet, as we notice in the film, he constantly comes up with good ideas. And so he's a marvelous image of inferior thinking. What's hard is to figure out the typology and the relation of the Tin Woodman to Dorothy, and this took a little bit of work with me. Why wouldn't the Tin Woodman, who worries about not having a heart, simply represent inferior feeling, in which case the whole thing begins to fall apart? So I spent rather a long time thinking about it until I realized that once again we have one of those movies where the heroine has two contrasexual figures closely associated with her, exactly like Katharine Hepburn with James Stewart and Cary Grant in the Philadelphia Story, and exactly like all those other movies that I just finished showing you, where the heroine has two male figures or the hero has two female figures. And so I realized that watching the Tin Woodman, that he has all of the qualities that I associate with introverted feeling, hidden gentlemanliness, and so forth. And I felt instinctively that he probably was worried about his not having a heart in a different way than the mind might think if one listens only to the words. It seems to me that the complaint of not having a heart that he's describing, and the poignancy of his, in fact, having a very big heart, is somehow different from the anxiety that the scarecrow has about not having a brain. One should not see these things as absolutely symmetrical. That's the mistake I think people make when they try to understand this story too quickly, that each of the problems, the problem of the brain, the problem of the heart, and the problem of courage, are cast in quite different forms if one looks closely enough. They're only superficially analogous. The problem that the introverted feeling type has is that the introverted feeling person feels things very deeply, but finds it very difficult to express those feelings openly to another. So that the lack of extroverted feeling is often a problem for the introverted feeling type and for others who are in relation to the introverted feeling type, so that the introverted feeling type often gets reproached with being cold, when the introverted feeling type is often one of the most passionately caring people on the face of the earth. But Rilke put it so beautifully in that letter to a woman that was getting involved with him. He said, "I love you, but it's none of your business." And often when I say that to a couple who comes to my office, when the man is introverted feeling and the woman can't find his feeling because she's looking for extroverted feeling, when I say that, it gets the same laugh in the office. And then we can begin to talk about it. And she can stop driving him crazy with a demand he can't meet. And she can begin to appreciate the feeling he does have. And this often is the way to unstick that particular problem. So it seems to me that the Tin Woodman is absolutely expressing that particular dilemma in his saying, "If I only had a heart." He's really saying, "If I only had a way to express the feeling I have." So it's a very different problem, in a way, from the problem of the scarecrow, which is a true inferiority complex around thinking. It's different. The Tin Woodman doesn't have an inferiority complex around his feeling. He has a despair of not being able to get it out, and that begins to unlock it. Nevertheless, on the face of it, calling him an opposing personality, isn't he just as much a sidekick of Dorothy as she is? Well, that's where I think we have to look closely at a bit of evidence, so I want to show you a quick clip from the film so that you can see how he actually comes up. No, I don't think he's a thinking function. No, because I think he's so strikingly introverted feeling in his every way of being in the world. So I don't think so. I don't think so. I wouldn't say so. I'm going to show you the meeting with the scarecrow followed by the meeting with the Tin Woodman so you can see the differences between the two characters so that we can show you that. Let me go back to your question for a minute before I turn it on. Let me go back to that. The truth is, as I look back, I did consider it intellectually, because if I only had a heart, that might be the thinking type who has inferior. But when I looked at the image, it wouldn't fit, so I rejected it. That's a more precise. I should describe my process. I considered it intellectually. I could not verify it experientially. So that's when I went back to the drawing board. Okay? Yeah.
What's he pointing the other way?
Most people
I can't make up my mind. I haven't got a brain. I'm only strong.
How can you talk if you haven't got a brain?
I don't know. But some people without brains do an awful lot of talking, don't they?
Yes, I guess you're right. Well, we haven't really met properly, have we?
Why, no.
How do you do?
How do you do?
Very well, thank you.
Oh, I'm not feeling at all. You see, it's very tedious being stuck up here all day long with a pole up your back.
Dear, that must be terribly uncomfortable. Can't you get down?
Down? No, you see, I'm...
Oh, well, here, let me help you.
Oh, that's very kind. Very kind.
I see how I can...
Of course, I'm not right about doing things. But if you just bend the nail down in the back, maybe I'll slip off and jump on the... Oh, what? There goes some of me again. Oh, no, I just keep picking it up and putting it back in again. My, this has been great. I didn't scare you?
No, of course not.
I didn't think so. Ooh. Ooh. You see? I can't even scare a crow. They come from miles around just to eat my field and laugh in my face. Oh, I'm a failure because I haven't got a brain.
Well, what would you do with the brain if you had one?
Do? Why, if I had a brain, I could... I could while away the young, confirm the risks of love, consult the risks of ring. And if I had mighty scratch and wild my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain. I'd unravel every riddle, for any instability, in trouble for its pain.
Oh, with the thoughts you be thinking, you could be enough for nothing if you only had a brain.
Oh, I tell you why, the ocean near the shore,
I could think the things I never felt before. And then I'd sit and think some more. I would not be just a knuckle, and my head all full of stubble, my heart all full of pain. I would then and be merry, life would be a ding a dairy if I only had a brain. This wizard would give me some brains?
I couldn't say. But even if you didn't, you'd be no worse off than you are now.
Yes, that's true.
But maybe you better not. I've got a witch and you might get into trouble.
Witch? I'm not afraid of a witch. I'm not afraid of anything. Except to light a match.
I don't blame you, no.
But I'd face a whole box full of them for the chance of getting some brains. Look. I won't be any trouble because they don't even think. And I won't try to manage things because I can't think. But won't you take me with you?
Why, of course I will.
Hooray! Well, off to see you, Mrs.
Oh, well, you're not starting out very well.
Oh, I'll try. Really, I will.
To walk?
To walk.
Because of the woman who makes you love.
How would you like to have someone come along and take something off of you?
Oh, dear. I keep forgetting I'm not intending.
Come along, Dorothy. You don't want any of those apples. Mm. Are you getting my apples on what they ought to be?
Oh, no.
It's just that she doesn't like little green worms.
Oh, you know.
Jung just blows up. He can't stand that. As we tend not to be able to stand having our shadow pointed out to us and our faults brought up, so that think twice before you correct an intuitive's mistake, even though it may gall you and it may reveal something to you. Sometimes the Ching's wisdom is quite wise in the hexagram 36, darkening of the light. The superior man lets many things pass without being duped. But Freud could not let anything pass. He really had to be the Yenta, I have to say. He would come right, and so Jung did not take well to that letter, and so he writes back. May I speak frankly to you? Can we talk? And he says, you know, you have the idea that you are going to get all of us who are your followers to get hold of our unconscious lives and our neuroses by pointing them out to us. But unfortunately, the game you're playing has the opposite effect. You expect us to see the motes in our own eyes, but all we can see is the beam in yours that makes you need to point out these faults. And this is a game you've been playing for a long time, playing daddy to all of us. And I have decided that you need my help in recognizing this problem that you have. So, I am going to continue to be outwardly your supporter and colleague, and I will go right on in my duties as the president of the International Psychoanalytic Association, or in my role in the movement, helping. But privately, I will tell you exactly what I think of you when you're doing this, so that you will not go on playing this game, because it's a destructive game, and as long as you do that, all of us feel that we don't have any neurosis at all. We just see how neurotic you are. And with that attitude, we know that you haven't been able to get out of your neurosis at all. So I want to help you, and I will send you on the side of our professional communications, personal communications, and this is the first of those, whenever I see this complex coming up in you. I have no doubt that this will annoy you, but I think it may help you all the same. That's what I mean by an offer you can't refuse. It's a paraphrase, obviously, but it's the tenor. Freud writes back, "Spare me your personal communications." Jung writes back, "Fine, I never force my friendship on anyone. The rest is silence. What this moment means to you, only you can say." And they go their separate ways. Not officially at first, because they have certain ties, but that's the end of the personal correspondence. All right. A year to the day after sending the letter, Jung has the following dream. It's in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and we know the date because it was the first day of Advent of 1913 that he had the dream, and it's exactly the... It's been established that the letter was sent a year to the day... the dream came a year to the day after the letter was sent. Jung dreams that... he's in an alpine landscape. It's a famous dream. And the sun is just dawning. And he hears a horn in the distance. And he knows, as I suppose any good German would know, or Swiss reader of German would know, lover of Wagner would know, that this is Siegfried's horn. He just knows it in the dream. It's just given with the dream that this is the horn of the great hero Siegfried. And Jung is standing somewhere beside with a brown-skinned man next to him. And sure enough, visible and coming at full gallop is Siegfried on his chariot, and the chariot is made of the bones of the dead, and Siegfried is on his way, and it's a mighty and fabulous sight. And Jung and his companion cock their revolvers, and he realizes that they're waiting in ambush. To assassinate Siegfried when his chariot comes closer. And at a certain point, the chariot does come closer, and they fire. They kill Siegfried. Immediately, a great rainstorm comes up. And Jung knows that the rain is going to wash away all traces of the dead. But an unbearable feeling of guilt remains. He wakes up from the dream. Now, this dream has been picked over quite a bit. Particularly, Freudian psychoanalysts have said that this dream pretty clearly is the anniversary dream of the break with Freud, and pretty much proves Freud right, that Jung must have had a death wish toward Freud, because here we have the image of the ambush, and that by the psychoanalytic rules of dream interpretation, Siegfried is a pretty obvious condensation of Sig Freud, and that Siegfried is Sigmund Freud, and this is the killing of Freud. Someone who took a more Jungian approach to the dream said that when you have an archetypal image, you have to at least make the effort to amplify it in its own context. So if you look closely, you will find that Siegfried, the great hero, is the son of Sigismund. Now, Sigismund was Freud's original name before it was shortened to Sigmund. So a more correct interpretation from a Jungian point of view would be that in killing Siegfried, Jung was killing his sonship to Freud. That was the identification that he was killing. It wasn't Freud that he was killing. It was the identification that he was killing. And that makes sense to me. Now, of course, breaking an identification feels to the person one has been identified with, like a killing. So one can see how Freud's introverted feeling would have felt the aggressive attack and how much it would have hurt. But it's quite a difference between killing Sigmund Freud and killing his identification. And the interesting thing is that the way in which the identification is broken, and by the way, Jung was called by people in Freud's circle the blonde Siegfried. He and Sabina Spielrein, who was his first psychoanalytic patient, the one he would talk about to Freud, had some kind of erotically activated countertransference. We will never know whether they actually slept together or whether, as some have felt, that Jung just sort of held hands with her and talked with her and sort of held her erotic. But whatever it was pretty intense. And they at least talked about the possibility of having a baby together, and the baby's name was going to be Siegfried. So there's a whole lot of associations in there, but they're all tied up with this idea of being the son and the general to Sigmund Freud. I mean, the whole Sabina Spielrein thing, in fact, was tied up with Freud, with Jung's desire to be the analytic son, the next generation top analyst. So, the interesting thing is that the way in which the identification is broken in the dream is ambush with the help of the brown-skinned man. It involves the shadow, and in terms of amplification of the image of the brown-skinned man, the brown-skinned man would refer either to the African or to the Indian, American Indian or African, and these would be cultures in which the archetype of the trickster is still very active. And what we're looking at is a tricky intervention. In other words, an ambush involves the archetype of the trickster. So we're looking at a tricky assassination. In other words, most assassinations are plots or conspiracies or trickster kinds of things. They're not just straightforward. They're lying in wait, catching the person unawares. So we might ask ourselves if that brown-skinned man was not, in fact, the very image of Jung's trickster function in my diagram. And here one would have to know type well enough to play it all the way through. Type is always a system of checks and balances so that the attitude, the I or E of the functions, alternate as one goes around. First function is introverted intuition, the second is extroverted thinking, the third is introverted feeling, and the fourth is extroverted sensation. So Jung's puer function is introverted feeling, which fits much of what I know about him. What then is his trickster function? The trickster, if you look, is the shadow side of the puer. It's the opposite side from the tertiary. That idea of the trickster as the shadow of the puer has been very helpful to me, and it comes mythologically right out of Ovid, who was the first to name the puer Eternus in the poem Metamorphoses, where one translation goes, "Behold Puer Eternus with his angel-seeming face, but oh, those invisible horns." And that beautifully catches the trickster shadow of the Puer. Now, I've teased them out into two archetypes, Puer and trickster. We get that with Peter Pan and his shadow that Wendy has to sew on. Peter Pan is losing touch with his own trickster side, and he needs to be in touch with his trickster side if he's ever going to defeat Captain Hook. So it's this myth. This is a very common mythology. Now, here's Jung trying so hard to be the good Puer to Freud, and here's this trickster that's unable to restrain itself. The shadow side of any function is simply the opposite attitude. It's as simple as that. So the shadow side of introverted feeling is extroverted feeling. Attitude means extroversion, introversion. So the shadow side of introverted thinking is extroverted thinking. The shadow side of introverted intuition is extroverted intuition. The shadow side of extroverted sensation is introverted sensation. In other words, these are in shadow relation to each other. And that's why they often are not found together. Usually introverted feeling and extroverted feeling people are usually not close together or are opposed. Now, I'm arguing that Jung has, on the right side of the diagram where the trickster is, an extroverted feeling brown-skinned man. Jung's third function is introverted feeling. That's the Puer function. That's this. What does that mean? That would mean the dream is showing us an assassination, an ambush. The dream comes a day to the year of the letter. Let's go back and look at the letter. The letter says, you know, the way you're working isn't helping the people that you're trying to help. You're trying to show them their neurosis by pointing it out, each flaw to them. But as you do that, you come across like a petty tyrant and a fault-finding father. And this game you're playing has a counterintuitive result. It has the effect of making us see the fault in you. I'm going to help you by writing you a series of personal letters that show you the problem that you're having. Do you see, extroverted feeling is being used in a tricky way? The extroverted feeling used in this way isn't experienced as caring, affirmative extroverted feeling. It's a shadow. It's a shadowy extroverted feeling that has a provocative quality. It puts the other person in a double bind. And that's what tricksters do. Tricksters put you in a double bind. So the double bind that communication puts Freud in is that Freud either says, thank you for taking the trouble to show me what I've been doing. I bow to youth. I need to learn. Well, at that point, Freud would have, you know, submitted all of his pride and authority to this younger man. Or the other point of view would be, I'm not going to listen to anything you say, which he couldn't very well do. It's not quite the way to say the other term of the double bind. The other way the double bind would be to... I can feel it. I don't know if I can say it. Perhaps you can feel it too. But the other thing that Freud could have done would not have worked either. So all he could do is leave the field, which is all you can do sometimes. So he said, spare me your personal communications. He just had to get out altogether. We might inquire what this trickster, shadowy, extroverted feeling must have felt like to Freud by examining where extroverted feeling was anyway for Freud. I don't think Freud, as we said, he didn't even like to sit and looking at the patient. I don't think he dealt all that well with direct feeling confrontation, even when it was coming from a good place. I've said that Freud's superior function is introverted feeling. So extroverted feeling for him was shadowy. In fact, it's in the place on my diagram that I have up there marked the opposing personality, the place where one experiences one's adversary, one's opponent. So Jung acted out through the trickster in his own psyche. But when he did that, he stopped being the puer, all right. He stopped being the crown prince, and instead he entered the role in Freud's psyche of the opposing personality. And there he has been ever since. That's how he got cast by psychoanalytic history as the deviant, the archenemy, etc. And there's this particular spin on Jung that you can get in most Freudian literature that all has to do with the role he then assumed in Freud's psyche. So that gives you a little sense of how these complexes come up in interaction, so it worked. The shadow broke the identification at the expense of making Jung the enemy. You see it, in other words, about Jung at that point. The attitude one often takes toward the opposing personality comes up, which is a paranoid attitude. One takes the attitude that this person is my enemy. And in fact, many, many years later, when Freud was having to flee from the Nazis and Jung was president of the International Medical Society for Psychotherapy, Jung sent some emissaries with money for Freud. And Freud turned them away and said, I do not accept help from my enemies. So that was how strong the opposing personality. It often only takes one really bad communication to completely throw off the entire structure of a relationship. So one does have to think about the impact of one's own complex on the complexes of others. A trickster complex for Jung was an opposing personality for Freud. But I think at some level, Jung's psyche knew that when he sent the letter, and that the letter was meant to destroy the possibility of the identification being continued, because Jung's psyche needed so much to be free, and he didn't know he couldn't do it any other way because he didn't yet know who he was. He only knew that he couldn't, and it welled up from within. It's only after the break that Jung begins to sort out who Jung is. It's only after the identification breaks down that he then begins to finally use his introverted intuition in a heroic way. And in fact, just after the Siegfried dream, a year later, he starts the descent into the unconscious. And he begins to look at the inner world, and he becomes the Jung we know. He discovers active imagination. He builds up his own theory of the unconscious. He eventually starts writing books with his auxiliary extroverted thinking that map out the world that he's found, and he creates a nomenclature for all of us: shadow, anima, self, and the system of psychological types. And at this point, he's in a creative, and he becomes Jung. He becomes an introverted intuitive man with an extroverted thinking auxiliary who goes about the task of creating a very useful and wonderful psychology. So all this adolescent stuff is over, and now he has his identity. I mean, and of course, if he had later all these things, he wouldn't have had to do it in this way. But he was so caught in something he wasn't that he had to use the shadow to break it in order to become who he was. And the best thing about Jung was that he could accept that shadow. Even though there was guilt, he could accept the need. He could accept that it was better shadow than no individuation at all, and he could stand by that, and so he grew. Well, we're going to take our half-hour break now and get some nourishment and so forth. And when we come back in the rest of the afternoon, I'm going to show you how, with this model of psyche behind us, we can make sense of some of the individuation stories that we are meeting nowadays. And you can see that this is a powerful tool, if it's used carefully, for unlocking an awful lot of what happens. So I want to sort of show you how it might apply to what I think we have been too glibly calling the hero's journey. I want to see it a little differently, using this model and opening it up into a theory of story. And so what we're going to do next is it builds on this, but won't just simply repeat it. Let's take a half-hour break. I'm particularly interested in the structure, but this could be used in just the wrong way, as someone pointed out, that it could become, in other words, it's creative to move around. And let's not assume that, well, it's open and shut. These guys couldn't get along, that was it, and it's all mapped out in their type. Someone said that would be the wrong way to hear what I was saying. They met at a particular time in their life when Jung was very much in need of coming in terms with his structure, and as long as he was living through Freud's structure, he couldn't. Now, in fact, they all have the same four functions being used in the same way, if you notice. They're just in different places. So theoretically, they should be compatible. I mean, in the sense that if you want to use this as a compatibility model, that people who you deploy their functions in the same direction tend to be somewhat more compatible than people who are opposed in their use of the function. And for a while they were. That is to say, it's a little easier for me, because I have extroverted feeling, to get along with someone who also has extroverted feeling, because we kind of use feeling in the same way. And I have to reach and stretch more to be with someone with introverted feeling than I do for someone with extroverted. But since I have developed a lot of introverted feeling, I can get there now, and sometimes I get along better with the introverted feeling people these days than the extroverted feeling. So the main thing is, structure is important at certain times in one's life, and for me, as a map maker, to kind of show you the background. But if it was used in a rigid way, I'd be very sorry, because that's not what this is about. There's no one answer to why people get along, and time of life, someone said, makes an enormous difference. But at the time of life when Jung needed to come into his own, living in, and that's a very adolescent identity-forming time, as often happens in men until their 35th or 36th year, they're not quite clear who they are, then that was too bad that he was living the identification with Freud, and we can use the map to understand that. Now, that gives me a chance then to go on. When Jung was still captured by the promise of the Oedipus mythologem, I may have to take a pastille. He cast the whole psychoanalytic journey, or the whole psychoanalytic project, rather, in hero's journey form. That was the book, Von Lagun und Symbole der Libido. And he said, maybe not Oedipus, but some hero myth is the right hero myth. And maybe it's the myth of the hero more generally. And that was a stratagem which Otto Rank also tried, and another early follower of Freud, who eventually wasn't able to stay contained in the Freudian movement either. And the idea of the hero's journey, that there's something heroic about dealing with the unconscious at all, and rescuing consciousness from the unconscious, has been pretty much the model that we've been working with. And Joseph Campbell has talked a great deal about this. I thought it would be interesting to try to take a story that we all know well, that certainly has its heroic aspect. But given the fact that there's a lot more we now know in the psyche than just the hero, maybe we could see if we could evolve another model than just an heroic model of story, just the hero's adventure. So I had several problems, one of which was coming up with a story that everybody would know, that I could count on, where there was sufficient imagery and a shared experience so that we could really do the kind of work I have to do with the individual narratives that I have in my practice. And as I was sort of putting together my ideas this fall, I was very helped by the fact that such a well-known story would actually be in general release around the time that I would be giving this talk. And that story is The Wizard of Oz, which some of you will have seen in the re-released print, which I saw just a few weeks ago. And it absolutely is a glory. If you think you have seen the film, you have not seen the film until you've seen this print. It's a staggering experience, as the re-released Vertigo was. In fact, one of the best things you can do for yourself is when one of these movies is restored and re-released, go to see it. The Lawrence of Arabia, the Vertigo, the Touch of Evil, and now The Wizard of Oz, all show a great deal more of what's in them when we have a chance to see them as they were meant to be seen. There's something to the entire production and the colors being the right colors that really makes all the difference. Let me read you a review that came out of The Wizard of Oz in November 20th, 1998, in the magazine Entertainment Today, under the title Friend of Dorothy by Owen Gleiberman. The special edition of The Wizard of Oz, same film, fantastic new print and sound, offers the rare opportunity to see the movie on a big screen, and for that reason alone I urge you to go. But it also offers a chance yet again to see why The Wizard of Oz remains the weirdest, scariest, kookiest, most haunting and indelible kid flick that's really for adults ever made in Hollywood. When it first came out in 1939, American sex roles were all but defined by the he-man, she-woman dichotomies of those other 1939 classics, Gone with the Wind and Wuthering Heights. Against that backdrop, try meditating for a moment on Oz, a place where Dorothy, a pigtailed girl with the voice of a 40-year-old chanteuse, is surrounded by men who've been eerily robbed of macho. The pipsqueak-voiced Munchkins, that glowering cranium of a wizard who turns out to be a complete wimpoid fake, and then, of course, Dorothy's yellow brick road companions, who may be the three gentlest knights errant ever imagined by the studio system. A cowardly lion, a tin man who weeps at the drop of his oil can, and a gabby dancing scarecrow with fists of mighty straw. This candy cane landscape, though, does feature one terrifyingly authentic vision of unfettered masculine force. It's not even a man, it's the Wicked Witch of the West. What's singular about Margaret Hamilton's performance is that with her thick, pointy eyebrows and fearsome chin, her terrifying Drano rasp of homicidal aggression, she expresses a male vision of ultimate violence bursting through the glass ceiling of feminine rage. The Wizard of Oz is our most indelible fairy tale because it prophesies with mythic surrealism a society in which the patriarchal brain, i.e. the wizard, is about to be torn down, in which women, i.e. the witch, have matched the male will to destruction and power, but where there also appears a benevolent new breed of valiant softy man, i.e. the scarecrow at all, who can make the world safe again. In 1939, this was but a dream somewhere over the rainbow of tomorrow. I thought it was an interesting review. And I thought it got at how subversive this particular film is to usual notions of the hero's journey, seems to me. And I thought it would be useful to take a look once again at Joseph Campbell's well-known model. Which is from The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Campbell describes this in chapter 4, where he says, "The mythological hero, setting forth from his common day Hutter Castle, is lured, carried away, or else voluntarily proceeds to the threshold of adventure. There he encounters a shadow presence that guards the passage. The hero may defeat or conciliate this power and go alive into the kingdom of the dark, brother battle, dragon battle, offering, charm, or be slain by the opponent and descend in death, dismemberment, crucifixion. Beyond the threshold, then, the hero journeys through a world of unfamiliar yet strangely intimate forces, some of which severely threaten him, tests, some of which give magical aid, helpers. When he arrives at the nadir of the mythological round, he undergoes a supreme ordeal and gains his reward. The triumph may be represented as the hero's sexual union with the goddess, mother of the world, sacred marriage, his recognition by the father creator, father atonement, his own divinization, apotheosis, or again, if the powers have remained unfriendly to him, his theft of the boon he came to gain, bride theft or fire theft. Intrinsically, it is an expansion of consciousness and therewith of being, illumination, transfiguration, freedom. The final work is that of the return. If the powers have blessed the hero, he now sets forth under their protection, emissary. If not, he flees and is pursued, transformation flight or obstacle flight. At the return threshold, the transcendental powers must remain behind. The hero reemerges from the kingdom of dread, return or resurrection. The boon that he brings restores the world, and that's the elixir." Well, I think we can see all of those elements in The Wizard of Oz. I think there's no question that we can see Dorothy's call to adventure, her early helper, Professor Marvel, and then the crossing of the threshold, which is both a sort of abduction and night sea journey, in which she, and a wonder journey, in which she goes through the cyclone, and then she gets her group of helpers in Oz, and she has her various tests. And eventually she does have to get the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West, and she has to make a connection to the wizard. There's a father atonement, and finally there's this flight back. Eventually, she has to leave at the threshold the magical powers and go and return. So we have the famous call, and then the adventure, and then the return. But somehow, the way Campbell has described the process, it feels to me too much as if